I don't have anything to disclose. I am an employee and owner of a company that does research and development, but most of our projects are funded by the NIH and the CDC. We create things. I am a behavior guy first and foremost. So the projects that were being mentioned are about how the crazy things that people do and how we might get them to do a little bit differently. Whether it's doctors in their practices or faith leaders, and I've been involved in fetal alcohol syndrome. So I'm an expert in nothing, but I know enough to make me dangerous in a whole lot of things, and I keep a lot of experts around me who know what they're really talking about in the actual fields that we're doing change on. Always glad that you can find things when they're really hidden in the back. I'll give you a couple little of nuggets to make it at least worth your while. If you like coffee, I found down the street, so I'm normally a wired kind of guy, but I managed to find a place down the street called Blue Bottle Coffee. It's hidden about a block and a half from here. Check it out. Really good coffee. And also, if you're by yourself and you need a breakfast, they had an excellent but limited menu of things. I think I had poached eggs with this really good sausage and a siphon of coffee. And it was just fabulous. So just a thing if you do it. Since it was led into, I'm not going to talk about this yet. I'll talk about expedited partner therapy. In case you haven't heard of this, it is something, one of the many projects that I'm involved in. Expedited partner therapy is you go to a doctor, and your doctor diagnoses you with a bacteriological STD, which sucks. But it's curable. And the big deal is that curable STD often boomerangs back around and gets somebody else because your partners are also infected. And what expedited partner therapy happens to be is CDC is promulgating, and a lot of states are adopting, the ability of a pharmacist, like our second speaker, to give extra medication to you to give to your partner to avoid that. Now, that's a fairly big deal because with only a limited set of cases, normally you can't do that. You can lose your license if you're a pharmacist. There are some prophylactic ways, good choice of words given it's STD. There are some prophylactic ways. Come on in. There's a bathroom around the corner if you need one. So anyway, that's all that is about. But I'm not talking about sex today. although I am tomorrow. I'm talking about social virtual reality. Some of the projects I've been involved in have had a social virtual reality component. And I'm going to talk about two of them and whether or not it's worth any additional attention at this point. Oh, by the way, I wasn't kidding. When I came in, I found out there's a bathroom around the corner in the actual room. So if you made the trek all the way over here, you got one of the great rooms that comes equipped with a bathroom. So feel free to head over. All right. I don't know how many of you know anything about VR, SVR avatars. I didn't know much about it a few years ago, but I had the opportunity to play in the space. And VR is basically just a simulated physical space. So we could make in a computer like this room, and it would have a bathroom, and you could walk over to it, and you could use it. So you get to play around in a space that's not real as if it were real. And there are all these questions in a virtual reality about whether or not it has a high fidelity. And all that means is if you go in and use the toilet, does it splash in the virtual reality around the toilet and make a mess, and does it have that stuff? Or is it just a toilet and you do it? It's how close to reality it really is. That's what fidelity is. Since you came, I'll give you a little bit of information. Social virtual reality, on the other hand, allows you to interact with somebody else. So you're in a space online, and you're able to interact with somebody else, much like a chat room, but you wear a costume, if you will, that's called your avatar. If you watch the movie Avatar, it's a fake person. It's not your real persona. You don it in the virtual world, and then you talk with other people. That's the whole notion of virtual reality, social virtual reality, and avatar. And so what we wondered is, since these things are getting a lot of attention, if you do some polls and research, you'll see there's a fair amount of funding and other things, where maybe these tools can be used to help patients. Maybe telemedicine can, maybe robots can, maybe social virtual realities can. They have these benefits that when it comes to either training doctors or working with patients, they can be anytime, any place. Kind of like web courses were years ago. One of the things that were, why is a web course good? Because you can take it anywhere you want to be. And so the argument is, well, inside a social virtual reality, you don't have to be co-located with somebody to interact with them. Okay. then we might be able to do some interesting training things that way. We might be able to do role-playing without actually being in the same space. And that's a pretty big deal, because in medical education, one of the key ways that a lot of people are trained is real play, role play, simulated patient education. Those are all the same thing for getting together in a room and trying things out. Okay? But you have to all be together in the same room. So social virtual reality might be able to allow you to do a little bit of that. The other thing is FaceTime with doctors. One of the problems with FaceTime with doctors is, well, you have this little 15-minute window, and then you remember on your way out, or purposely forget until you're on your way out, the doorknob question that you really wanted to ask them about, but you don't have time to talk to them. So the question is, you know, can we allow doctors and patients to interact in a social virtual reality in a way that allows them more FaceTime, more the ability to interact and do different things? So anyway, SVRs, these kinds of things, can be anytime, any place. They could be scalable, meaning they could be used by a lot more people than just being in a room. They are less resource intensive. I don't have to hire actors if I'm doing simulated patient things and put an actor in every room. Usually that's how we do it when we're doing case education. And they can be anonymous. This is another interesting thing, is that nobody needs to know you're a dog on the internet. Nobody needs to know that you are a white male playing a black female if you're behind an avatar and that's what the case calls for. One of the hardest things that a lot of places have when they're doing training is that, especially using simulated patients, not simulated in the tech sense, but I'm pretending to be a patient and you're interacting with me, is I may not be able to get the talent that fits the profile that we want to do for a particular case when we're doing our training at IUPUI, at IU School of Medicine. I do a lot of work with them at UK, those different places. It's hard to find the people, the talent. So they can pretend to be whoever they need to be just by putting on, the word we talked about earlier, a different avatar. And if they've been scripted, the language can be correct, the case can be correct, and all of that. So there's a lot of possibility there. So, and as I said, in the case of SVR, they are social. Social virtual reality is social. I get to interact. It's a space that you can interact in with a body, as if I can see your facial expressions and so on and so forth. So we want to know, we conducted two fair, we want to separate this whole, all what I just said is, ooh, you could. So we're separating that, ooh, you could, from the reality of what you can really do in the space. And we conducted two large-scale NIH-funded projects to do this. They weren't solely targeting the SVR stuff. We actually had a more bread-and-butter thing in both projects. We were trying to do some training materials for different issues and support materials. But we wove in the social virtual reality as something that would be more research interesting to us, you know, something new and different that people hadn't tried at the time. First one started back in 2004, I think. So one of them, as I said, was as a tool for improving provider substance abuse education. How can we do a little bit of that? How can we use a social virtual reality to make it better in terms of education? The other was as a tool for enhancing diabetes patient-provider interactions. So two sides of the coin. Can I improve my education of a provider? Can I improve the education of the patient provider? I mean, the education of the patient, but then also the interaction between a patient and a provider. So we had these two worlds that we developed. One was a clinic in which ESPRT is performed as part of usual care. So I got to tell you what expedited partner therapy was. Most of you have probably not heard of ESPRT. You may or may not have. If you're in a public health clinic, you might have. ESPRT, not pronounced spurt like Bert and Ernie, but it's ESPRT, is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. NIAAA, NIDA, they want physicians and other people to ask every one of their patients at least once a year about drug use and substance abuse, and they want some other things to go along with it. Everybody, not just the folks in high-risk areas. Whether it's an ER, whether it's a pediatrician, you do a screening, you do a brief intervention, which is a little bit of motivational interviewing to change their behavior, and then you refer to treatment. Just trying to pick up earlier in addiction cycles and misuse cycles things that are going on. So what we were interested in is, can we improve some education? Can we? And in fact, the question was, can we migrate some of the case education to a social virtual world? And how would that? What would that end up looking like if we did those role play in a social virtual world? The second one, we created a diabetes center. This was a challenge grant from NIH. From NLM, National Library of Medicine, where patients can interact with providers and learn more about diabetes. So two things we wanted to do in there. What happens if you put resources in the world? But then more importantly, can patients schedule a time to visit with a provider In this case, we tried to use the actual provider and more on why that doesn't work, but we'll get to that and sort of increase that interaction by allowing them to dial in, log in, walk into the space, walk around a virtual clinic, if you will, and take care of things. So, and I already told you what these were all about, but again, ESPRT, multiple agencies trying to do it. ESPRT is a social skill because it's me interacting with you as a patient. How do I ask the questions? How do I get you to change your behavior? How do I get you to accept a referral? But we use role play for that a lot, real play, but this whole simulated patient thing, not very scalable. Can we make it scalable? We built a world. So this is a very simple map of a clinic, an overview map of a clinic. When you're in the space, and I'll show that on the next page, you walk through and you just basically are in two exam rooms where you're allowed, where you can interact with patients. The patients are trained actors following scripts and cases that were developed through interaction with subject matter experts and vetted with some of the docs. And there's a place where you can pick up the screening tools and learn about the protocols in this particular clinic. And your role as a doc, if you come in, is to act as a, you're basically a newbie at the clinic, and you have a couple mentors who will show up from time to time and tell you how the ESPRT thing works and so on and so forth. We also generated avatars, these are a couple of them, for the cases, for the patients who are going to be visiting, and for the doctors. So these are two of the doctors. Everybody in Second Life tends to be handsome and chiseled. We did this in Second Life. You could do it in Active Worlds. There's a lot of different tools for doing this, but what I'm going to say doesn't really matter which platform it is. These were from some original video cases that we developed in another project. So we used them as models, and those cases as models, for creating the avatars that the actors were going to use when they were interacting with the patients. Interacting with the docs. The docs would wear one of several different avatars, depending on what they wanted to show up as, and then they would go in and run through a case. So they'd be in the office, the patient would come in, they'd have a primary complaint not related to substance abuse, and they would be able to interact with them. They were located throughout the country. They weren't co-located in any way, shape, or form. And so that essentially how that transpired. And as I said before, if you're in this space and you're walking through, you pick up the forms, you can interact with the patient. This is Deidre talking to Dr. Sue. And you know, the space is populated with different things that you would see in a normal office. This room is a little different. I said, you know, one of the things that I said we might be able to overcome by doing this stuff in these kinds of environments is the co-location problem. If I want to do role play, I have to be co-located, which you don't. We did show that. You don't really have to be co-located. I got a whole bunch of buts about that, but you don't have to be co-located. But you do have to be at the same time, contemporous. But one of the things we did to sort of get over that a little bit is not role play, but we captured these interactions. And that we messed with the technology in order to be able to capture and set up cameras and record what the patients were doing in their role play. And then you could watch, this one happens to be a video that showed up, but you could also pull up that interaction that was going on in the space and review it. Could review it with the doc who just did it, or you could review it later as another doctor who wanted to learn, another resident is actually who we're working with, who wanted to review what was going on. So in that way, they didn't really have to be there because they could just come and review the materials later, but they couldn't participate in role play unless they scheduled a time to come in and do that. So what we found was, yes, an SDR can make simulated patient education more scalable. The learners, the patients, and the experts could be co-present without being in the same place, and they didn't have to be all dressed up and show up. They could be at home doing whatever they want to do, and they have their avatar. One of the things that we struggled with a lot in this project but managed to get it to do was communication can be textual. The basic communication in most of these things is just typing, even though you see a body. But you can use voice. A lot of the tools will allow you to talk on the same time, or you can dial into a conference and have it. So you can do the voice. And a lot of our time went into this thing, the facial expressions. There are, you know, when I'm a doctor and I'm trying to read you and tell what you're thinking when I'm doing it, I have to be able to read your facial expressions. So from the initial design, we worried about everything about facial expressions. We looked at all the research on facial expressions. There's a lot of it out there. We spent a lot of time getting tools built together to allow the talent of the actors to control the facial expressions. So there's all this stuff. Turns out, You only need two things to convey what the doctors need when they're interacting inside these worlds. One, eye contact, which by chance, which happens, doesn't come for free in a lot of these environments. Because if you're in these environments, the eyes tend to roam all over, which doctors take as a sign of lying. You're not looking at me, you're not making eye contact, you're lying to me. So our first time through, when we didn't have the eyes focused directly on the doc, they didn't think that patients were very truthful with them. Issue, we had to make them make eye contact. And then the other thing was, it turned out to really convey what we wanted, all we had to do was then deviate from that. You know, if we wanted to feel like that, if we want the doctor to pick up that the patient's not really liking what they're talking about, just drop your head and eyes. Didn't take a lot. Wouldn't worry about the smiles, the frowns, the different things. It was really boiled down to those two things. But it can be done. We controlled it all and managed to get it done. Finally, I mentioned, you know, we were able to record the interactions and other strategy and other stuff, which sort of deals with the same time scalability of role play and real play. So all of this could be done. In the second world, you're going to let me know when we got lots of time, right? In the second world, so that's all about, like, what might you do with SVR, social virtual reality type of thing to improve education. Bottom line, yes, it can be used for some role play stuff. I'll drop the other shoe later. But yes, it can be used for that. And it works. Technically, it works. The other side, what can you do with the patients and the doctors? As I said, the lack of face time is an issue. Can patient management of diabetes be enhanced? Can we get them to interact with the doctors? And can we add some extra stuff? You know, as I said, we looked at provider training for ESPRT. Now we're looking at the interactions between the patient and the provider. So we built a world. This particular world was the Diabetes Guidance Center. This was a project, I didn't mention it, but we actually are in partnership with Indiana School of Medicine when we do this stuff. It was mentioned that I have a company. I basically created my own research position when I came out of school because I didn't want to move from Bloomington and I had a lot of projects and things going on. So since then, I've had 15 years of just being engaged in fetal alcohol syndrome, sex education. If you've dealt with a depressing topic, it's probably been in my bag, and it's probably been in my bag pretty recently. ADHD, conflict resolution, that one was actually pretty fun. Okay, so we built a world. In that world, the patients can come and visit. In the lounge, they check in with receptionist. Something we did a little different with that one is we scripted in an ELISA kind of artificial intelligence kind of way the initial bot to allow them to have a conversation with the patient as they came in, and they can ask them questions about their health and so on and so forth. We didn't push it too far because mostly it was for hits and giggles, because anytime you try to create those kinds of artificial intelligence thing, very first thing users do is try to make it say funny stuff, which they all do. Kids and adults alike. So, but you walk into the space, you're able to interact with different people. You can go watch, there's resources you can go get and take a look at in the space. But then you can meet with a team of providers. So you sit down and schedule meetings both as a group and talk about, in this particular case when we were running this one, I think it was actually a group session talking about fitness. Yeah, it was fitness and exercise. And then these guys were actually talking about this, the impact of diabetes on sexual health, which was kind of fun. But so we meet with doctors, and we proved that you could show up and the doctor could talk to them. And so the technology allowed them to do that. They could do it with voice. They could do it with text. So in testing, we again showed that, you know, you can support the patient-provider interactions. I'm glossing over the whole world-building stuff because that's relatively straightforward to make the actual spaces. But you can support the interactions. We can provide educational materials, and we can conduct small group things. People will come in, and they will talk to each other about whatever they're... So if we have scheduled times where, you know, today we're going to talk with an expert, and we bring an expert in from the real world, and people would show up. Sometimes in our studies we made people show up because we just wanted to see what it would look like early on, but later we'd do some outreach and see what would happen. So they would do it. Here's the thing. You can, but should you? A lot of the research in my own presentations in the past have been, can you do this? There's absolutely zero question that you can do all this. If you see somebody asking the question and you're reviewing a grant, say, that's not interesting anymore. You can. But should you? Here's the thing. We can make, as developers, worlds do the things we're talking about, but it's hard. Facial expressions, giving voice to play nice, the kinds of voice that you can do in Second Life Active Worlds, those kinds of worlds, pales in comparison to having a Skype conference. I will tell you what's nice about some of these in a minute, but it's just very hard to do the stuff. Yeah, that's fine. Very hard to do the stuff. Users can use the systems. Doctors and patients use them, but it took a lot of hand-holding. We've built some of these where they were standalone and all you had to do was launch something. We've also done them inside of Second Life, which is an existing world. Users go places they don't mean to be. Users go places they don't want to be. In Second Life, you can show up in a red light district without a whole lot of issue, giant phallus waving in your face. These kinds of things get in the way. So while you can use standalone commercial tools already or roll your own, there are usability issues. People just run into problems. The sound craps out. The technology doesn't work. There's a lot of cognitive overhead. So not just for the users. The users have trouble. They don't know how to log in. They don't know what they're doing. So it's a big learning curve to get to where you need to be. But they also, there's a lot of cognitive overhead for my actors. Okay, so you can imagine if I'm an actor, or if I'm me, because it found we didn't have to use actors when we were doing it because we're no longer face portrayed on the screen, you know, as a role play. It's rather somebody is controlling a puppet behind the scenes. But if I'm going to make a facial expression, I'm interacting with you, and I am saying, I may be verbally saying something, or I may be typing, depending on the channel we're using. I'm typing something. I'm also having to pay attention to how to do my facial expression, which we get for free in the real world. And I'm also having to deal with how you are reacting. So I've got all this extra processing that's going on when I'm trying to do it. But it can be done. And saying all of that, users thought it was a nifty thing. None of them really thought they'd use it now, but they could see the possibility and thought it was a nifty thing. And finally, real-world people, as I said, are unlikely to use such systems. Too much time, too much effort, too many barriers that get in the way so far. There may be developments down the road that make it easier. Providers simply don't have the time. So in terms of, we knew that going in, but we were just curious. It was more of a, well, could they? But providers never want to do anything. So you imagine a doc running into a barrier as they're trying to use a tech, which they don't really want to spend the time on anyway, and it's just like the kiss of death for future use. So they're just things because, so I would argue, you know, you can do all this stuff, but should you? Probably not now. Maybe down the road there'd be some uses for it, but I'm not so sure. So as I said, can we deliver education this way? Yes, but there are far easier, more efficient methods for doing it. I'd go even further and say, and we argue about this in staff, but I like to be strong-willed guy, and say, you know what, anything I could do, and I have this on another slide, but anything I could do in social virtual worlds, no matter how well I could do it, I would argue I could do better through other channels. Group talk, provision of education, role play, maybe even Skype would be better. Depends on the scalability. There's a lot of some possible caveats. But really, I've seen enough of it to know that, you know, well, yeah, but why don't we just use, and that's a viable answer. But again, our original question was a can question. And it's, you know, now it's a should, or what kinds of things can you do. Can we support role play? Yeah, as I said, we can. Can we support provider interactions? Yes, but they won't do it. So as I said, there's really no question about can anymore. It's a focus on should we, and if so, what technologies, what can we do to the technology to remove the barriers? But I want to take, and those barriers were cost. Production cost, hard to do. Implementation cost, hard to get people to do it right and to get it rolled out and keep it care and feeding. Cognitive costs. Things get in my way from my learning objectives because I got to learn how to use a system in order to learn what I'm going to learn. That's never good. So it's the PETA factor, pain in the arse. Just things get in the way. Why has it got to be so hard? But I'm normally enthusiastic about a lot of things, and that sounded really negative, so I do want to say, but this is interesting. The anonymity, the role play, the mediated social interaction. I am in a space. I don't have to be who I am. There are other ways to do this, but this is really what's unique about these worlds is I don't have to be who I am. There may be some possibilities there. That's one of the things that's really of interest. So I think if there's any potential in this, it's that. It's that ability to interact with other people as someone not myself, and I may feel more comfortable. There's all sorts of psychological reasons why that may make me open up more. I'm not sitting in the room with a doc. I might be more willing to ask the kinds of doorknob questions that everybody puts off to the end because they don't really want to ask about, doc, my penis is not working anymore during diabetes education. I mean, because of my diabetes, what can I do? They put that off. And so maybe they'd be more willing to do it. So as I said, in the end, there is no single thing that can be done in social virtual world that cannot be done as well and quite likely more elegantly and effectively through other methods. There is the possibility of improvement of social virtual reality technologies, but if anybody in here is involved in these things, I want to argue that a better hammer is not a saw. And what I mean is the social virtual worlds, I can make the stuff, I can envision making everything about them easier to use. It doesn't mean that they're going to be good for the things that I'm talking about, for education and for supporting providers. So making a better hammer, making my hammer work better, doesn't make it into a saw, doesn't make it something I should cut with. So just because you improve a tool doesn't mean it's going to be good for the things you want to use the tool for. Yes, we can use it for education, but I'm strongly negative about the things. But I will leave with the question becomes, are there unique things about these worlds, and I suggested one, that cannot be done in other ways through other technologies? Can I enable people to interact in a certain way, in a rich way? And another one that I have not mentioned at all is in several of these worlds, like Second Life, there were, I don't know the numbers most recently, close to 1 million users. So we may not be able to use those tools to reach out to people in the real world and get them in there because of all the barriers, but there's a lot of people in there. And for our project with diabetes, for example, there's a lot of diabetics in there because just the proportion of people in the population, it's hundreds of thousands inside a population of 1 million who have either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. So one of the last things we're actually doing, and it's for World Diabetes Day on November 14th, is conducting all of our other stuff was reaching out to people in the real world. How does it work for them? Putting all the barriers in the way. We're doing an outreach for Second Life. We would like you to come and learn about diabetes, meet some experts in the field who will be there at different parts of the day, and interact with people, interact with providers. Is there any utility to us providing messaging through that, just like we would with Facebook or Twitter? Just another channel to send things out and what's going on with that. So that's the last thing that we're really looking at with that. So I don't want to, I'm not normally a curmudgeon, but I've had enough of this that I've seen it and I've beat my head over it that I also tend to be the guy who says, well, NIH wants a website to do this thing. And I'm the first guy who says, why a website? Or why whatever, what's the best tool for the job? And having messed with these enough, I don't see them as useful tools for a lot of the stuff that we do. If you happen to be a social virtual reality researcher, I apologize. It is interesting work, and it can be done, and I think it merits further investigation, but it's not real world work that's going to get anything done anytime real soon. All right, so as I said, that's who I am. Those are our grant numbers. If anybody has any interest in any of these projects, I am happy to discuss them, show you what we've done, take you on a tour of our virtual worlds. But other than that, thank you.